You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestall. We head to the beautiful land of Sweden on the search for all manner of high strangeness in the company of author, researcher and investigator Fred Andersson. We uncover some of Sweden's more unusual UFO encounters, the strange beings that lurk in the forests, and some of the folklore associated with this wonderful country. And a big thank you to Fred for being a courteous and informative guide to his home country. But before that, of course, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. You can click the link in the show notes as usual, and thank you to each and every one of you who continue to support me and the show through your contributions. Thank you. Mysteries and Monsters is across all social media platforms. Please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. You can also visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for news and episodes. Our exclusive merchandise store is available through TeePublic, and you can click the link in the show notes as always. Our intro and outro music are performed by the marvellous Weary Pines. Thank you as always to Dean Bestall for his wonderful artwork. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. Now, the Kingdom of Sweden beckons us, or perhaps it's simply the whispers of the Tomte that we can hear emanating from the woods. We head to a territory I've yet to cover on the show, as we venture to the beautiful country of Sweden, in the company of author and researcher Fred Andersson. In his recent book, Northern Lights, High Strangeness in Sweden, Fred shows us that strange things occur everywhere, if us over here could be bothered to investigate. Fred, welcome to Mysteries and Monsters.
Thank you so much. Finally, we're sitting here. It's been a bit tricky to connect us through the internet recently, but I've been so busy with work, not UFO related, I must say. I've been doing a show about seniors finding love, a TV show. I've been very, very busy just being a matchmaker, you can say, through my behind the camera. It's kind of like I'm just trying to purge my mind from senior activities, you know, and love and romance, you know. At the moment.
Well, let's hope this is as we should call it, a palate cleanser then, to free you of the shackles of your day life, my friend. I mean, it is one of those things, as I said in the introduction, Fred, when I saw your book come out last year, I was delighted, because I am always interested to learn more about countries as close to the United Kingdom as you guys are. You know, you're a couple of hours away on a plane, if that. Gordon Bennett, you can even drive to Sweden, really, if you wanted to, for England. I mean, it'd take a while, but we could get there.
Yeah.
Thanks to your wonderful construction of bridges and tunnels. And so I was fascinated to see this, because there are obviously a couple of cases, as often happens in Europe, Fred, that kind of break free, and English researchers or British researchers managed to think, oh, this case is so strange or so fabulous that it eventually gets translated into English and we all know about it. But being as close as you are, and the fact that even for someone with not too much understanding or knowledge of the Swedish high strangeness, I'm aware that from the end of the Second World War, the ghost rockets appeared in all over Scandinavia. That was a big thing. And yet, it seems after that, we kind of went, well, we can't be bothered with what's going on up there anymore. And so we've left it to people such as yourself, Fred, to kind of collate this information and then, as I said, release them to the darker sides of ufology that finally understand just how wonderfully strange Sweden is.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the reasons why I wrote the book. I mean, because I felt that the information about Swedish cases is so minimal. You know, you can find reports in old, you know, issues of Flying Saucer Review, for example. Many of them are, I mean, to be fair, we're talking about a time period where everything was aliens also. So sometimes the truth, they took some freedom with the truth, both from Swedish researchers and onto British and American writers and journalists. Mm. So I wanted to clear things up a little bit, at least, because many of these cases are still huge mysteries. But I want to say that I tend to see myself mostly as an observer, you can say, of weirdness. I often doesn't judge a case when I read about it. I try to find the original report. I try to find the earliest writings about it. But to be honest, it's less important to me what the truth really is, because what I find most important is what does the experience give the witnesses? How do these stories evolve over the years? I've gone through many, many cases, Swedish cases. Some of them I've discovered are, you can't trust them. Some of them have only become even more mysterious, more weird, more strange. So anyway, I felt, okay, I need to write a book so people who, English-speaking people, we'll get a chance to read about this in modern times. They don't have to look at in old copies of UFO magazines. They can turn to me, you know, for what. So I don't know if that said, maybe, you know, I have a tendency to ramble, so I'm just trying to do it. Because I get so enthusiastic when I start talking about the subject. I noticed that now. It's been a while. I'm also very, very annoyed, even up to this day, how English-speaking researchers, they don't get the facts right when it comes to Swedish cases. They kind of mix up names, they kind of mix up dates, years. Sometimes they, you know, it's totally wild sometimes. I won't mention any names, but a friend of mine, a great researcher, he put out an article recently, and I read it. It was about the Swedish case, and I felt nothing is correct here. It's kind of just... I haven't asked him about it, to be honest. I don't want to discourage him from it. But it's stuff like that, you know. I just want to tell the story as proper as possible, you know. Because, as you know, on internet, the stories tend to evolve not in an organic way. It's mostly about sloppiness, I would say. Sorry, I'm going out hard here. I'm usually quite friendly. But
well, I think it is one of those things, Fred, because when you're passionate about a subject and yet you seem to be away from the main bodies that do the research, it's almost as if they take a sort of pick and mix approach to Scandinavian strangeness, that they would only sort of choose it. And as you say, I think often they'll find a case and they think, oh, this looks really interesting, and then probably just run it through Google Translate. And therefore you miss all the nuance and the knowledge that is included in the native language, because with the greatest of respect, yes, these tools are amazing, but mm-hmm. it's not like actually speaking to someone who understands and speaks this language as their native tongue. And so they may be trying to do these things with the best will, but as you say, they would get the dates wrong or the locations wrong. And often some people haven't even been to the country, so they will describe the flora and fauna, and you would look at that as a native and think, hang on a minute, are they talking about Scotland here? This doesn't sound like Sweden. And I think it's one of those things, because as I was saying before we started, obviously I've been to Scandinavia several times, and so I was always aware of certain aspects of Scandinavian folklore and the differences between each country's They're very similar, but there are a lot of differences as well, despite the fact that you're all close neighbours. And so when I looked at it, I was just amazed when I went to Norway the first time to see how much they embrace the troll in Norway. That it's everywhere. It's on the street. It's in the shops. I've yet to see a troll not doing any job, it would seem, Fred, in Norway. I've had my picture taken with several of the statues out there. And so I think when people come, they're quite surprised how sort of open and upfront Scandinavians tend to be about their folklore and their history.
Well, I, you know, when you look at Swedish folklore, I mean, UFOs and humanoid reports, it's, of course, we have a couple of very, very famous ones. But what I find very intriguing, in UFO Sverige, the UFO organization where I'm active, we sometimes complain half jokingly that there is no humanoid reports anymore in Sweden, but that's not entirely true. Here I want to connect to folklore, because what people see all the time is the Swedish version of the gnome.
Mm.
Which you find literally hundreds of reports and witness accounts from people seeing these creatures still up until this day. And they look like the classic gnome, you know, with beard and pointy hat and everything. So I would say that part of Swedish folklore is actually a lot more stronger and I've also found that several of those classic UFO cases we have in Sweden from the beginning it was more classic gnome folklore than aliens, for example. But then they've evolved over the years through interviews and, you know, people have written about it. And suddenly we're talking about aliens and not, you know, fairy tale critters. So if you go out on the Swedish countryside in Sweden, and especially, of course, among the older generation, you will still hear them talk about gnomes. It's not strictly gnomes as in the UK, for example. We call them tomte.
Yes.
Yeah, tomte, which they kind of look similar, but they're very different, you know.
Yes.
Now I have no idea what I was answering here, but what question I was answering. But yeah, the folklore part of Sweden, the older folklore, is still very much alive. To me, it's very, very connected to the UFO phenomenon and light phenomenon and all kinds of weird shit people seeing in the forest. for me, it's the same, basically.
Yes. Yes. Well, like you say, the tomte is very well known. I mean, I'm aware of that because it's very similar to what we have in the area that I live in here in the Peak District. We have boggarts.
Boggart,
which is essentially like a house sprite, or it helps you, and you have to feed it. And as the one thing I know about the tomte is that they love a bowl of porridge, Fred.
Yep. Yeah.
Which is a very similar thing, that you've got to sort of say thank you or give them a gift to keep on their right side. And have you, over the last few years, seen, because obviously here in the United Kingdom, that the investigation and the belief and the discussion about the fae and the fairies seems to have really exploded massively. And with that, they've started looking all around the world to other countries for their history. Have you noticed that things like the tomte and huldra, which I think is the other female denizens of the forest, who have a wonderful story about seducing men?
Yes.
and if the man sees their back before they marry, then the wedding's off, because apparently their back doesn't transform until they marry a human. Is that right?
Yeah. There's a lot of different versions of that. But one thing with the back is when the huldra or skogsrå is luring the men into the woods, and when they embrace her, they can feel either that she has no back at all, it's just a hole, or it's made of wood. And of course they are driven insane by this. And I found a pretty new a sighting of a huldra quite recently. There was a guy who wrote to me, and he was camping on an island. I don't remember the lake now, but he was on an island and he was alone in his tent. And as usual, I think it was like 3 o'clock in the morning. He woke up by, you know, this fear. He felt this fear. There was something around. And he looked out the tent and he sees a woman. He described it. It's clearly a woman, but she's half a tree. Huh. So half the body is a tree, half is a naked woman. And she seems to want him to come to her. And but he, thankfully, he's very, very scared. So he gets back into the tent and manages somehow to fall asleep again. And when he wakes up during the morning, of course, there's no woman there and there's no tree either, you know. So every time I find these newer observations of forest beings, nature, spirits, etc., I find that, you know, incredibly fascinating. I think I have at least two observations of Näcken. Näcken is this naked guy who plays violin and lures people into rivers and streams and drowns them. Yeah. Oh. So two of them I found. One woman was out walking in the forest. This is not Näcken. She was out in the forest and she hears a trumpet. Someone playing a trumpet in the middle of the wilderness. And she comes out to some, you know, little meadow or something like that, and she sees a tomte, I guess, a very, very small humanoid playing a trumpet, standing on top of a log or something like that. But she also, you know, she just stood there for a while looking and listening, and then she walked away, which is, as you know, in UFO cases, it's so often people see something utterly strange and they kind of just, okay, and then they leave, or they don't film, or then they don't photograph if they have a camera. My guess is that the experience itself, it's so weird, it's hard to comprehend. So, you know, what to do when you're in a state of mind like that? You know, I would probably just observe. I'm not sure I would ever bring up the camera. I'm not sure I could. Anyway. Folklore in Sweden is alive and well. I love that. Yeah. Very, very little trolls, though.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, that's, for me, I've always been quite surprised by this, because I know, as we've touched on, the archive of the unexplained is in Sweden, which here in England, we've got nothing like this, Fred, at all. Mm-hmm. Such a resource and a library of collections that have been brought together. In the Swedish culture, how is the unexplained and the strange viewed then? Because I think, once again, people have perceptions about certain countries and their populace, Fred, mm-hmm. that I think, for people like us who love the weird, I just think, well, I'm just really jealous, rather than, that's strange. What is it about Swedish people that they seem to be quite open to these kind of discussions, as you say, because you've got a rich mm-hmm. belief that has continued into the modern era about the folklore and the beings that exist on the peripheries of our lives. And yet, as I said, you can go to the other members of Scandinavia and they've all got very rich histories as well. Mm-hmm. Do you think this is because of your history and the cultures and the fact that through your dark winters that your ancestors spent a lot of time talking and creating stories, and that tradition seems to be ingrained into your sort of cultural DNA over there?
Yeah, you might be right there. I mean, most of the cases I've looked into in the book is during the winter months, for example. I think it's the storytelling tradition in Sweden is, like you said, it's very, very rich. People like telling stories, but they don't like to tell stories in front of a lot of people. They like to tell them within families or among friends in close groups. I feel that the reason why this lives on is that we're still a pretty secular country, you know, when it comes to religion. Of course, you know, we have a state church and everything like that. Hmm. But when Christianity came to Sweden in the, when was it? In the 1100 or something like that, 11th century, or even maybe 10th century, there was some kind of uprising against it. Christianity was ingrained everywhere, but the priests, the clergy, soon realized that the Swedish people or the people in this part of the world really, really had problems letting go of these old traditions and this mythology. So they kind of integrated it in quite creative ways. For example, priests in old Sweden often hanged whale bones inside churches and claimed it was the bones of giants, because the belief in giants were very, very large in Sweden. Mm-hmm. Through that, of course, they wanted to say that the church, you know, this is what we do with giants. So by doing that, they basically confirmed that, yes, there is giants, you know, there is giants. The politicians of the time and the clergy had a deep respect for tomtar and similar things. They never really denied it or said it was just, you know, stories or you know, stuff like that. They kind of embraced it, but they also said it was dangerous, because the tomte, for example, and the troll and the huldra were basically Lucifer's minions that fell to earth. but you know, there is this thing with when a big religion comes to a country, at least during those times, you have, I'm trying to find the word here, that's why I'm rambling a little bit. People don't want to be told what to do.
Yes.
Basically, they don't want to be told what to do. So I think that's why they continue to embrace the gnomes and the trolls and the fairies and the huldras, everything like that, and kept it as a very dear part of our mythology, a very dear and beloved part in most cases. And I mean, Sweden is like, I think we're like 70% forest, for example, forest and wilderness. Most people live out in the countryside. They live very, very close to nature. They can see the how the forest and the fields and the lakes can be magical. You know, It's a lot because we're so close to nature. You know, if you know any Swedish people like me, you know that when the summer comes, no one is at home. Yes. We're outside in the nature, or if you're lucky, you have a cabin somewhere. It's so important. I think the nature part, that we love nature so much, have kept the stories about the magic that is out there so alive over the years. But yeah, maybe our skepticism towards big religions might be a part of it. You know, we feel that maybe, I mean, the tomte or they're like underdogs, and we want to root for the underdogs. You know, yes, in cases yes. like this, it's a good question. I never really explored, you know, the reason, but. Yeah, that's my 5 cents about it.
Yeah, well, it is as well, and I think because the way the main cities in Sweden are situated as well, Fred, yeah. because you've kind of got Stockholm on the east, you've got Gothenburg on the west, and you've got Malmö towards the south, yeah. and so everything else in the middle, as you say, is essentially forest and lakes and beautiful parts of it, and you've got major towns and things, but obviously there's such a sort of disconnection from your major cities. I think that you've got this fertile breeding ground in the rest of Sweden, where they're not exposed to the modern world as much. They're a step away from the past, as it were.
Yeah. I mean, I live in Stockholm, but I live in a suburb to Stockholm. Mm. And where I live here, you can walk 10 minutes and you have forest in all directions. Yes. And this is still a suburb. is even considered a dangerous zone to some people. It's not, I can tell you that. And we have lakes, we have forests and fields and animals. We saw a moose yesterday. First time I ever seen a moose in the wild. So yeah. I'm very, very happy because of that. So, and you can find that even, you know, all through Stockholm, nature. Just walk 10, 20 minutes out from the suburbs and parts, and you will find all this amazing nature. So I think that's so ingrained in our culture to be in that kind of environment. And I also believe that when you're in this environment and you're away from the noise of the traffic and people, you kind of goes in some kind of meditative mode. Mm. I'm not saying you meditate, but you find a calmness in yourself. At least I do. A calmness, a peacefulness. And that state, I would say, opens up to experiences, you know, to different kinds of experiences. It could be deep insights, or it could be something you see or hear. I'm very happy you bring up nature, because I think nature is really one of the keys to the phenomenon, the liminal spaces between the cities where everything can happen. I love old forest roads. Mm. It's one of my favorite, you know, if I find a forest road, I just walk it, because it's kind of like transporting yourself through time and space. I don't want to sound too new age here now, but there is some magic in it. Yeah.
It is. I think you're very correct there, Fred. I think once you embrace nature and allow yourself to sort of free yourself from modern life, you kind of, as you say, without wanting to get a bit new age about this all, you kind of feel yourself transcending a little bit, and you begin to notice things, and it's almost like your sight and your sound sort of change, and you become a bit more receptive to things that in your normal 9-to-5 hustle and bustle, you wouldn't give a minute about. But a bird song, or like you say, seeing a creature as beautiful and as intimidating as a moose, is both awe-inspiring and a little bit dangerous.
Yeah, it is. The thing with the moose yesterday, we were out walking. We were out for hours. We took bikes quite a long way, and we were out in this forest we'd never been to before, climbing up and down. And then we came to a deforestation area, kind of like a field in the middle of the forest. And I told my partner that, you know, I've never seen a moose in the wild. Let's see a moose.
Mm.
And he said, yeah, let's see a moose. 10 minutes later, that moose came walking there. It came walking, then it saw us and got scared and ran away. But it's still a moose, you know. Mm. So I think that's a good example of what happens when you're embracing nature, when you're out there and you just let everything go. You let we didn't bring cell phones or cameras or anything like that. We just let all of that shit go and just be there, and then you'll see things.
Yes, absolutely. So I suppose as well, as we were saying about some of the incredible encounters that you have in the book, and some of the wonderful Swedish history in regards to strangeness. Mm. I can't start without mentioning one of my very favourite UFO cases from Europe, Fred, which is this incredible account that happened in 1958.
Mm.
And the thing that's always struck me about this particular case is that the occupants or creatures that these two gentlemen encounter didn't sound like anything else that was happening at that time. Obviously, it's the 1950s. People are sort of talking about beautiful aliens coming from above to seduce us, as happened to Mr. Villas-Boas and others. And you've got the contactee movement in the US, where we were getting visitors telling us all about how to change his life. This case is one of those that I love, because it's balmy, as we would say here. It doesn't make sense. It's all a bit strange. It's a little bit frightening in a peculiar way. And I'm one of those people, Fred, I don't understand why more people don't know about this particular case, because it's always been one of my favorites.
I think it was kind of too offbeat when it happened, or when they claimed it happened. I mean, with this I read somewhere someone describing these beings as loaves, kind of loaves of bread, kind of, or dough, you know, grayish, something like that. It is a very fascinating case. For you who don't know about it, it was two young men in 1958 who ended up by the side of the road. I don't remember how. They saw a flying saucer. I think it was quite classic flying saucer also. And these weird loaf-like creatures outside who starting to kind of chase them. One of them, I think, even grabbed one of the guys. And he was holding on to something, and you know, he was pulled back and forth until they managed to escape. So for yeah, I agree. For 1958, it's truly unique. It's a case that has, it's questionable, but it's not. Here's the thing: both these young men they passed away a long time ago. You know, they were known to be kind of like troublemakers, tricksters in the area.
Yes.
One witness, a friend of them, told Klaus Svahn, who is a major UFO. Klaus is a good friend of mine. Have you had him on the show sometimes?
I've not. Yeah. I would love to speak with Klaus. He is a legend in ufology. Yes.
Yeah. You need to have him. He can probably tell you a lot about this case because he's been truly investigating it. But they found a friend of these guys who this friend told them that they made it up. But that's basically the only person who have said that.
Yes.
But I don't dare to talk too much about it because I know Klaus, and you will have Klaus on, I'm sure of that, he will probably tell you so much more about this case and the ups and downs of it and that what makes it interesting, what makes it less interesting. But honestly, even if it's a hoax, I still love it. Mm. I don't mind if it's a hoax because a good hoax can be so damn good anyway, you know. So I've always wanted to visit this spot where they claimed they saw the flying saucers and battled these gray loaves. It hasn't happened yet. I'm sure you're aware of the Gösta Karlsson encounter in 1946.
Yes.
When you go to this particular spot now, he actually built a flying saucer in concrete that stands there. So you walk through the forest, and he have with concrete marked the kind of the burn marks in the ground, and he have the flying saucer in the middle, and he also marked where the aliens for a couple of hours buried, or they wanted to bury their dead because they had an accident or something like that. But that's one of that's one of Klaus' cases because he's written a fabulous book about it, only in Swedish, but it's like fantastic. He turns every damn stone you can find when it comes to this case. Gösta Karlsson himself, he was also one of those, I don't know what to believe, to be honest. He obviously experienced something in 1946. They found diary notes from, you know, the years after where he writes about it or he hints, you know, that something happened. But the story itself didn't become public until I think the early 70s when he came out and talked about it with a journalist named Eugen Semichov. And so I'm sure that he made up certain things. Why? I don't know. He was a storyteller, you know. He likes to tell and spin stories. But there's parts of it which is very, very hard to deny, especially those early notes he made. Mm. You know, because why would he write them down in the early 50s if he wasn't, you know, planning to talk about this, you know, until early 70s, you know, like 20 years later, you know, so something happened. The question is what, of course.
Yeah. I mean, as well as, do you think that was probably because the culture and the conversation in the 1970s was a lot more open to these subjects Fred, than it would have been in those early 50s. You'd got the Cold War paranoia going on. You've got a lot of things like that. And obviously the UFO subject at that time seemed to be dominated by what was going on in America. Do you perhaps think that, as with some of these situations, when we talk about different types of phenomenon, it's only when popular culture catches up that someone feels comfortable enough to have that conversation 25, 30 years after the original incident, perhaps?
Yeah, it could be. I mean, during the 60s, the contactee movement, or the more esoteric versions of ufology, came, you know, became, I'm not sure I can use the word big, but it became more popular in Sweden. And, in, you know, organizations were started, people were talking about it. I think they brought George Adamski to Sweden, for example. You know, all these kind of things. So maybe that was something that inspired Gösta Karlsson to talk about his experience. Maybe it also inspired him to maybe boost the story a little bit. For some reason, maybe he saw something that was good for his. I mean, he was a rich guy, you know. He was he didn't do this really to earn money or anything like that. It was it's such a difficult case in that way, because it's so many layers and parts, and it's like a. It's like fractals in all directions.
Yes.
You know? Yeah. Yeah. But then again, you know, I've seen aerial photos of the area from the 50s, where you can see the circular burn marks in the ground, for example.
Yeah.
Then some people say, okay, maybe it was some kind of circus was there, or it was some horses that walked. You know, I don't know. There's so many theories, but the fact that the circles he later put concrete in were there at least in the early late 50s or early 60s, according to the aerial photos. But then again, I don't know what to believe. I think I think it's a part inner experience of some kind, which doesn't make it less real. I need to say that, and part. The result of a showman, a storyteller, a man who liked to tell stories, basically. Yeah. And I think I'm not judging him, because it's still something that made his town world famous, at least inside within ufology.
Yes.
I really think it's worth a visit if you're in Sweden to go to Ängelholm and go to this place, because it's a quite magical place. And when you're standing there with the trees around, it's like an open area in the forest.
Yeah.
And you look up at the trees and you see the spot and you feel that, yeah, something went on here. Something went on here.
Yeah, it's very similar, I suppose, Fred. You could say a parallel to the Bob Taylor incident at Deckmond Woods here in Scotland, which seems quite similar. That you've got a very sort of down to earth man who didn't need to sort of talk about a strange encounter that they had, and yet because of the person involved and some of the additional information, people have taken that as a really compelling incident, because once again you've got a very matter-of-fact person involved in this, but you've also got similarities in regards to something coming, something being seen, some kind of experience. Obviously not as extreme as the Swedish case, but obviously Bob Taylor was very well known as a very well thought of man in the local area who had an encounter that changed his life.
Well, one of my favorite cases in Sweden is the Vallentuna UFO flap.
Yes.
Which is like, I mean, I've been to the locations, I've met witnesses, I've been there, I talked to them, and it's still, because I want to balance things here, because now I've been, oh, Gösta Karlsson, he made things up, and Domsten might be a hoax, but Vallentuna is one of the more intriguing cases of what I would say a UFO flap we have in Sweden, outside of the ghost rockets, of course, which is still fascinating as hell. Well, in 1974, it was a series of events But the 23rd of March in 1974, Gösta Häger, who was a school janitor, was walking home from a party. So he was a bit drunk, I can tell you that. And he comes to this narrow road close to a runestone. There's a lot of, you know, ancient stuff there around. And he sees this bright light coming towards him over the field and hits him down. And when he wakes up, he stands outside his home, like three, four kilometers away. Later, during hypnosis, he very leading questions was asked. I can tell you that. But he told the story that he met some transparent Native Americans. Basically, that's how he described it. And was in some kind of space, and they were communicating with him, and they gave him a mission, and he never revealed what that mission was or is, because Gösta Häger is still alive, and he was quite old at the time. He must be closer to 100 years old now, so I never dared to call him. Maybe he doesn't want to talk about it anymore.
Yeah.
So that's the odd part of the more weird aspect of this case, because the next night we have this family, the Andersson family. Andersson was, I think, 36 at the time, and she was expecting friends to come over to meet her and the kids and her husband. They couldn't come, and she decided, okay, maybe I will call my parents. And she tries to call her parents, but the connection is down. She can't reach them. This makes her very, very worried. So she puts the kids in the car and drives, I think it's 9 kilometers, to her parents' home. And she starts to see, the whole family sees a bright spot following, like a bright little sphere, a ball. But she really doesn't think so much about it. It couldn't be a helicopter or, you know, an airplane or something. But it's there. And when she arrives to her parents, they meet her at the porch. And her dad says that his television is down, the telephone connection is down, everything is fucked up. And he didn't say that probably, but so the whole family is outside on the porch talking when they see this strong light and they see this massive craft. They think it's a craft, at least big as a, you know, like a bus basically.
Yeah.
And they can't. Hovering over the forest, not far away from her parents' home. And they see beams coming up from the ground into this craft, you know, they can kind of sense that there's three windows or three holes in it. And the whole family sees this, kids, Hillevi, her parents, and they get scared like hell. Her children start screaming, but Hillevi, she's so cool. She's still, you know, she's 84, 85 years old now. I met her a couple of months ago, and she's such a curious woman. So after, you know, returning back to the house, she discusses this and she says, I want to tell my brother about this. So she puts the family in the car and they drive to her brother a couple of kilometers away. When they arrive, he asks them, what's that light following you? And they turn back and they see this UFO following them.
Oh.
So you can, in normal cases, people would get scared. Hillevi, she loved this. So she put the family in the car again and started driving, basically following the UFO.
Yeah.
Until they come to a crossing, she stops the car, and this UFO is, you know, shining some bright light towards the car. It's like daylight inside the car. And of course, I talked with one of the daughters who was in it, and she said she had this urge to go outside and kind of join the light or go to the light or something like that. Mm. And then it was over, and I think they drove back home. But that night, there were tons of people who saw stuff, mostly bright lights. But Hillevi's and her family's encounter are definitely the most, you know, spectacular one. Where, I mean, everyone, you know, still today, we have absolutely no idea what it was. Mm. It's a true mystery.
Mm.
Yeah.
So, I mean, for you guys, I know obviously a lot of people look at 1973 in the States as being a stellar year for so many incredible, as some people call it, the year of the humanoids in America. Was 1974 a very similar year to you, because obviously, as you've just been saying about the Anderson situation there, you've also got this wonderful mass sighting by these school children who were going ice skating on the Tomah River. So, you know, this is what, but this is one of those wonderful stories, Fred, where you've got a mass sighting of a group of children in a particular period where children weren't having mass sighting.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm surprised that the Vittangi encounter, the Vittangi mass sighting, isn't more well known, because it caused some headlines at the time and some investigations. And I believe they never came up with a, you know, anyway, I'm surprised it's not talked about, because we had, I think it's like 13 or 10, 15 kids who were out ice skating in this lake. It's far up in Sweden, really, really far up. And to see an object coming over the mountains towards them, a bright light. They did drawings afterwards, and there is some similarity, but it's also a lot of creative freedom from each kid there, what they saw. Some was more classic flying saucer shape, some was more, most of them are some kind of ball with light or sphere with light. And it came closer and closer, and the kids got so scared, so they started to run from there, of course, and, you know, run back home. But they could see how this sphere seemingly landed either on or behind an island outside, out on the lake. It's one of those cases. I've been trying to find the kids. The problem here is that many of them have very, very generic names. So it's, you know, very common names in Sweden. So it's a bit tricky to find, you know, because there was probably a lot of kids during a certain year who was named that name, because most of our last names are Andersson or Larsson or Johansson or something like that. It's so common, so common. But there was a period, you had the Westall school sighting, and which this kind of reminds me of. It also reminds me of the Ariel school case from, what is it, 94? Mm. I tend to, we all know kids have a very vivid imagination, but so do adults. I can tell you that. but there is something with a collective of people, there's something that intrigues me with it, because now I don't know how to describe this in English, but if 10 people see something, probably all of them will describe it differently, but there will still be certain things that makes them similar, you know, some detail. And it was the same thing in the Vittangi case as in the Ariel School case. And to me, maybe I'm naive, to me that kind of points that they had some kind of real experience, because all of them noticed a certain detail of some sort. They didn't made it up. They saw something. Then again, what it was, I can't say really. You know? But it's one of those cases I would love to mostly get the time to look even deeper into. I would like to talk to them, but I failed so far to locate the kids, and it's been a number of years, and some of them have probably passed away by now. They should be in their 70s, I guess, 60s and 70s.
Yeah.
So it's one of those. Yeah, maybe I should just dig more into it now. Mm. I don't have any work this summer anyway, so.
It's your next project then, Fred.
Yeah, maybe.
But like you say, I think this is often the striking thing about mass sightings. It's like you say, some things will be different, but some things, there's a core that goes across every witness. And you can see this in this kind of situation. It's the same with the Ariel. It's the same with the Westall incident. It's the same with the Broadhaven incident here in Wales.
Yeah.
That you have these core elements that don't change. Some people may see slightly different colors, or say the shape is slightly different, and somebody might remember windows or a porthole on top or something like that. But essentially, they will all say it looked like this, it came from this direction, it landed, it flew about, it hovered. There are different things. Certain, the descriptive abilities change from person to person, but I think the core element of the witness account is essentially the same. It's just all the additional bits that will often change more often. They seem to be more malleable, as it were.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I think that, it's no secret that of course popular culture and UFO books and everything affects your perception of what you're seeing. That's, for example, still. If we connect back to old Swedish folklore, I mean, people are still seeing today, they don't see updated versions of tomtar. They still see the same kind of tomtar they saw 100 years ago or 200 years ago. That's a detail that fascinates me. Of course, the tomte symbol in Sweden is well known, and we have all these children's books, etc., etc. But it's fascinating. I mean, if we should follow the logic compared to UFO cases and tomte cases, the tomte of today would have like space suits or rocket backpacks or whatever,
yes,
this is space helmets. But it's never happened. When it comes to those kind of observation, they just kind of stayed the same over the years, which also is, one reason why I think there is a lot of truth in it, because if there's something it's dangerous to say I'm sure of something, but I'm pretty sure that there is that kind of creatures running around out there, mostly because the amount of witnesses, there's so many observations of it. But I mean, yeah, the 70s, by the way, was the golden era of UFOs in Sweden. It's never been the same since then. We have a few really cool cases in the 80s also, and some in the 90s, and some more modern. But I mean, in the 70s was like, hey, this is, you can open an old UFO magazine, a Swedish from that time, and you find something. What's happening? What's going on?
Well, yes, and I think as you say there, with these kind of parallel phenomena, it's an easy explanation, Fred, to say that people who are seeing aliens now are simply seeing a modern interpretation of creatures from folklore. And I've seen that from both sides. I've seen people who research the Fae claiming that people aren't seeing the aliens, they're seeing the Fae. And I've seen people who believe in aliens who say, well, these aren't the Fae or the Tomte or anything, they're just an alien that people can't explain. But therefore I think both are one of those things, as you say, when we talk about the absurdity of certain cases or the strangeness of them, that if people were seeing one or the other, then these two things wouldn't be running in parallel. And yet we know, regardless, once you open the Fae doorway and you've got the extraterrestrial doorway as well, both people are seeing things that are very, very different, because I can't think of many aliens running about with a beard or wearing a silly hat. And as I say, I can't remember many members of the Fae wearing a space helmet and a jetpack. Yeah. So it can't be one or the other if both are still being reported to me, Fred. I just think it's both of them trying to grasp onto things and say, no, that's ours, not yours. Get off. We own that.
Yeah, but now I lost myself here, but it's, I could, I don't know what to say. I don't know what to comment right now. What pops up in my head is just a lot of different weird, folklorish cases, kind of connected. There's a few of them when we're talking aliens and tomte, or aliens and folklore, that springs to mind. One that I will probably write about in my upcoming book, whenever I will finish that book, is it's interesting for Well, it depends how you see it, because there's absolutely no proof it happened. But a number of years ago, I found a hypothetical article about folklore, aliens and tomtar. It was written as a hypothetical, you know, this could happen.
Yes.
This could happen. And that story itself was so weird. And it was at the beginning quite unclear if this was made up or if it was a real story. So the story is someone is out in the forest. They encounter, they sit by the fire. They encounter a flying saucer. No, it's not. It's basically a fly agaric, Amanita muscaria, but
yeah.
shaped like a sausage. In a sausage, saucer. I mean, yeah, sausage. That would be something. So it's like a flying saucer looking like a mushroom.
Yes.
With a doorway in it and three legs and everything like that, and some beings coming out from it. And I at the end of this article, they had a little note saying that all of this is made up. So I wrote to the guy who wrote the article and say, where did you get this story from? And he said, I just made it up, just to, as an example, the absurdity of it all. So a couple of months later, I'm going through old newspaper clippings and I find a letter someone written to a magazine. This was like 79 or 80 or something. And it tells the exact same story. That someone's grandpa told this story to them, that he was out in the forest. He was looking for a cow. He sat down to rest. He started a fire. Suddenly he saw this mushroom saucer standing beside, you know, a couple of meters away, basically. And you had these small beings come out of it. And the person who wrote this letter said that this what my grandfather told me, this is the truth, according to him at least. So I'm here, I'm very fascinated in how someone 20, 30 years later wrote a hypothetical article of a folklore alien connection. And by chance, I guess, or maybe some kind of, maybe he read this this letter a long time ago. I mean, he wrote down basically the exact same story and the absurdity of it. And I tend to believe that this was a real story. Yeah. I was very, very disappointed when I realized that a new article was just made up. But when I found this old letter, I was like, wow, this is such an interesting, very, very physical connection between these two themes, the yes. folklore with mushrooms and everything, and the modern flying saucer or the UFO. So I still think they are very, very connected in one way, but there is some kind of mystery with the folklore aspect of it, how these creatures and beings stays the same over the years. I found a few, very, very few troll observations, and they kind of feel like kind of look like the trolls of the early 1900s. There was an artist called John Bauer who painted trolls. So that was kind of that's the kind of more modern version of trolls. Before that, trolls in Sweden were quite beautiful. Mm. They were like supermodels, basically.
Yes.
So here, Paul, you have one of my ramblings. I'm not exactly sure where I started. I'm not sure where I'm going to end with this, but I could tell you about the flying saucer mushroom instead. So yeah.
Well, that's interesting, because one of the other cases I've seen you write about, Fred, is very similar to that, kind of where the line is blurred between UFOs and folklore, which is the Rings of Cansta. These two young chaps, Torbjorn and Krista.
Mm-hmm.
And once again, here we are. I think this case is also from the early 70s as well.
Mm.
And I know you've postulated about this, that you think this is one of those cases where this may have more of a folklore fae explanation than the normal UFO.
Yeah, to me, when I read about it and I found the original reports, for me it was all folklore. It felt more like a portal to Magonia or something like that. Yes. You know, like, you know, it, more than a UFO. It's a very, very interesting case in its simplicity somehow. You know, they see, what is it now, two rings. I don't remember if it was one or two rings. And you see this little sphere going around them. It's like a, I don't know how to describe it. Well, if, to me, it's not a UFO. It's not, we're not talking aliens here. We're talking about something opening to somewhere else. Yes. I also like the thing that the boys, they weren't far from home, but they couldn't find their way home. So they had to trust the dog to show them where they lived, which is a highly intriguing detail of the case, how they kind of, maybe for a moment or two, they weren't even in this reality even more. They were somewhere else, and that's why they couldn't find their way home. So that's why you have a dog who can just straighten you up and, you know, save you.
But also, as well, they clearly had enough about them, because I think, was it Torbjorn had a cap gun?
Oh yeah.
And he thought, right, I'm not having this, I'm going to shoot it.
Yes, I forgot about that, yeah. And I don't know if that was a wise decision or not, but would you do that if you found a secret portal in the forest? Would you shoot at it? Would you? No.
No, I don't think I would, Fred. I'd just be stood, my mouth agog, I think.
Yeah. Same here. There was a couple of, you know, during these years were a couple of interesting cases with kind of these bright lit portals, portal-ish things people saw in the forest. There was, I think, within a month in 1978, there were two of those in Sweden where people were out in nature somewhere. I remember one girl was out jogging, and in the forest she sees this almost like a doorway standing, and it's so bright and it's almost fire-ish in its appearance, and she can see a silhouette, a humanoid silhouette in this opening. And she, of course, she gets scared and she runs home and she takes her mom there, and of course is gone. There was another one with a boy experience, basically the same thing, but it was even more fire, it was even more wild. But the same thing, it was the silhouette standing in it. So maybe just hypothetically, what Torbjorn and Christer experienced was one of those portals either closing up or about to open. You know?
Yes.
Yeah. So, you know, good for them. You know, we might never have seen them again, you know, if they have entered it. Or if they started, maybe it was good that they started shooting at it, actually.
Yeah. Well, I suppose, Fred, do you have these kind of zones of strangeness where you have a lot of people disappear in Sweden, Fred? I know there are certain, you know, and I know you dislike the term portal in general. And I have to say, I think it's one of those easy explanations that gets on my nerves as well. But there seems to be certain locations that are known for people disappearing. And sometimes you have to take a step back. And I think, as we were saying earlier on about the topography of Sweden and how it is, you know, a very lush forested landscape. It's a wild country. People forget this, I think. We're too used to looking at the world and how things are in the UK that, yes, we've got large expanses of forest and national parks, Fred, but a lot of us is built up, certainly in comparison with some of the countries in Europe. Do you have one of these hot spots where people seem to just vanish, that sometimes, even though we know, as you mentioned earlier on, you've got some pretty large creatures wandering around your landscapes there are still cases where you think, that really makes me scratch my head?
Well, I wouldn't say we have any of those areas in Sweden. I mean, of course people get lost and disappears, but I also think we can connect back to this thing that Swedish people, at least, are very, very used to nature. So I don't think we have so many disappearances as in certain other countries. You know, we're kind of used to be out in the forest and everything like that. We have, of course, areas where people are seeing stuff, or they claim to see stuff or experience stuff more than any other places. One of my favorite locations is at Öland. It's an island outside Sweden where there's a road, and it's a straight road that goes straight over the island. There's no turns, there's nothing. It's just a straight road, you know. And I've talked with two people, I think I mentioned this in the book, who kind of got lost on these roads.
Yes.
They feel like they're just driving and driving and driving. You know, there's no end to the road. Or one of them, he and his son, felt like they were somewhere else suddenly. They went, for example, they went down a hill. This is a very, very flat island. It doesn't have any large hills or anything like that. But they were, as they perceived it, they were driving downhill for like 3-4 kilometers, which is impossible on that island, for example. So we have stories like that. But when I wouldn't say, you know, don't go to that forest or you will get lost forever or something like that. It's nothing like that. Not what I've found, at least.
Good. I'm glad to hear it.
Yes, it's nice, you know. I don't want to be scared of the nature, you know.
Yes, no, absolutely. I think it's right, though. I think when you look at kids in Scandinavia are brought up from a very early age to respect the outdoors. There's a lot of winter pursuits. People enjoy hiking, skating, climbing, skiing. It's an area where children from a very early age become very comfortable with nature, Fred.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm not a skier myself, for example, but as early as I can remember my childhood, my mom and my dad brought me out into nature or on the sea or lakes, you know, everywhere. It's yeah. I think it was, at least in my generations, I'm not sure about younger generations, but it was a very, very important part of our childhood. And like I mentioned earlier, if you go through Stockholm and you just walk a little bit from each suburb, you have these massive forests and lakes and everything. People are used to this kind of environment. I still think you should be do some training before you go up in the, you know, the real mountains, etc. Yes. Of course, especially during the winter and so on. But we don't have that kind of places. I was thinking about this the other day, actually, because there was a producer from an American TV show who emailed me and said, "Hey, Fred, we would like to do something about weirdness in Sweden, some UFOs, some Bigfoot, whatever, something like that." And I said, "Yeah, of course, I can do that. I can help you with that. Takes a little bit of work, but I have my resources. I can do it." Yes. And then it went quiet, of course, because I guess they understood I wanted to get paid. anyway, so like a month or two later, he emails me again, and he says, "Hey, Fred, have you looked into it?" And I said, "Yeah, I mean, we have some stuff here," and then I told him, "But why don't you do something about tiny humanoids in Sweden? You know, like Tomte, etc."
Yeah.
Because we have tons of that. And he wrote back and said, "Well, it's not scary." It's not scary. And then I started to think, you know, we in Sweden in general, we don't have a fear culture when it comes to the paranormal.
Yeah.
You know, for example, like the United States, where, you know, you have Dogman and Bigfoot and, you know, you have all these monsters roaming around and they, you know, of course you have peaceful Bigfoot also, but it's a lot more about scares and fears and everything. Like in Sweden, we hardly have that. When people experience stuff, they're rarely scared. They just like perplexed, like, "What the fuck?" You know, it's more like that. And so that might explain why we don't really have these areas where people disappears mysteriously, because we're not used to that kind of fear.
Yes.
You know. Yeah. Of course, you have stories about Huldra, etc., and trolls, which worked as a warning to not go too deep into the forest, but we don't have a Skinwalker Ranch or, yes, or stuff like that. Yeah. We don't have a what's this guy's name in the he always do stuff about disappearances in national parks.
Oh, yes, David Paulides.
Yeah, exactly. We don't have that stuff. We don't have, people aren't scared in that way. They can be very, very confused, but they're not scared.
Well, I think the last thing I want to touch on before I let you go, Fred, is, as I was going to ask you about this, but obviously you've kind of tempted me earlier by mentioning this, that you're working on another book. So as, yeah, as I said at the beginning, your first book in English, anyway, your certain first full English publication is one that I think anybody interested in weirdness should have, regardless of where they're from in the world. So is your second book going to be sort of a following on from that kind of thing, or are you going to focus on a specific methodology in regards to the type of cases that you look at, or is it just going to be another wonderful collection of weirdness from all kinds of the Fortean world?
Well, it will be similar in that way that it will follow my usual way of thinking and reasoning when it comes to weirdness. But I will totally focus on tiny humanoids, on tomtar, on these small characters running around farms and in forests, and I've dug up some really, really cool cases, very, very intriguing. Some of them with more witnesses than one, because you always want to, you know, when you have two witnesses seeing something like this, it's truly something special. So that's what I'm working on now. I had to let it go for a couple of months now because I was working on a TV project and I just felt I can't fit any tomtar into my brain at this moment. So my that's I've written maybe half the book so far, and it will be kind of similar as the other, as Northern Lights, but mainly focusing on the weirdness of small tiny people basically. Oh. And a few monsters also, or monsters, it's, they're not monsters, they're living creatures like you and me.
Yes.
Because it's so many of them. I kind of felt overwhelmed after a while because I found so many observations, so many people writing down their experiences. So I was like, where do I begin? Where should I go with this? Because it's too much, actually. Yes. So I'm working on that slowly. I don't dare to say any date or anything like that. It will come sooner or later.
Oh, well, fabulous. I can't wait for that. That sounds fascinating. And I think, as you say, it's once again, as we were saying about, well, it can't be the Fae, it must be an alien, it can't be an alien, it must be the Fae.
Mm-hmm.
So yet here we have another wonderful collection of modern sightings, which will be marvellous to read. I can't wait to get my teeth into that.
Yeah, I hope you will like it. And I hope to come back and talk to you about it when it's out.
It would be a pleasure, Fred. It would be a pleasure. So, my friend, I will let you return to your wonderful Swedish afternoon. But before I let you go, where can everybody find your work, follow your blog, and keep up to date with everything strange that's going up in Sweden?
Well, I would say I'm mostly active on Twitter nowadays. Homo Satanes is the username, even on Instagram. And I also have an account on Medium. You can just search for Fred Andersson, Andersson with two S, and Medium, and you'll find it. It's been a while since I posted an article there, but once again, I'm blaming it on the work. You know, it's been too much. So I would say that's the best way to see what I'm up to and what I'm writing about. And please connect with me. I love having new friends all over the world, even on Facebook. You'll find me. Search for my name, Fred Andersson, and see when you find the guy with the big mustache, it's probably me there. So please do that, you know. And I love hearing stories. I love really love hearing stories. The weirder, the better, you know. So it's a fabulous interest to have this.
It certainly is. Well, listen, Fred, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to finally speak with you. You haven't disappointed me, as I knew you wouldn't, with such wonderful tales of high strangeness and weirdness. So I want to say thank you. I cannot wait to speak to you again. I'm really looking forward to your next book. You are always welcome to rejoin me here on Mysteries and Monsters. And I wish you the very best of luck for the rest of the summer. You take care, my friend.
Thank you. You too.